You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of American Hustle by Rachel Deloach Williams. We are here because we want to help you, the trainer began, but to do that, we need to hear some truth from you, Anna. It was the same old song and dance. Anna stuck to her story, claiming that all she'd said was true. Nothing was her fault. Anna sat across from me as the women relentlessly pressed for answers, for names, for a way to reach Anna's family. I said very little as I watched. I seemed to float outside of my body while tears ran down my cheeks. Against the raised voices and direct accusations, Anna's face assumed an unsettling blankness. Her eyes were empty. I suddenly realized that I didn't know her at all. With this epiphany came a sort of release and a strange calmness. I understood the women's anger and disbelief. I'd had those feelings for months, but I had come through to the other side, and I knew that there was only one answer. The next day, I emailed the New York County District Attorney's Office, linking to an article about Anna. "I think this girl is a con artist," I wrote. An hour later, my cell phone rang. The caller ID read United States. I picked up the phone as I stepped away from my desk. "We think you're right," a voice said. An assistant district attorney confirmed that Anna Sorokin, also known as Anna Delvey, was the subject of an ongoing criminal investigation. On the last Wednesday in August, I awkwardly lowered my tote bag to the floor, resting it against the wall, before turning to face the roomful of Manhattan Grand jurors, nearly 24 faces dotting curved tiers of seating that reminded me of a college classroom. I assumed the position of a professor, though I was hardly fit to teach the group. I, the dupe, the dope, the sorry case. And then I recalled one class I might now be qualified to teach, or serve as guest lecturer, the only one for which I'd received an A+ during my time at Kenyon, the Confidence Game in America, an advanced-level English course taught by Lewis Hyde, who'd written a book all about tricksters. Trickster makes this world. Well, at least the irony was gratifying. I stood behind a small wooden table in the front of the room. The court reporter sat to my left, and an assistant district attorney stood at a podium to my right, next to a projector. The foreperson, a woman about my age, sat in the center of the back row and asked from above, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?" I did. It turned out that I wasn't the only one who'd believed in Anna. At the grand jury hearing, Anna was indicted on 6 felony charges and 1 misdemeanor charge. I realized the scope of her purported deceit as I later read the indictment. She was accused of falsifying documents from international banks, showing accounts abroad with a total balance of approximately $63.6 million. The reality of Anna's behind-the-scenes dealings, these figures flying from one account to another, remains dizzying to this day. It's astonishing that she was allegedly orchestrating such elaborate schemes while maintaining a believable surface cool, wielding her debit cards to pay for dinners, workouts, beauty products, and spa treatments. She conjured a glittering, frictionless city. Whatever one wanted would be bought. Wherever one wanted to go was a cab ride or plane trip away. The audacity of her performance sold itself, until it collapsed under the weight of its own ambition. It's a part of why I believed her, and continue to believe her. Who would think to make up such an elaborate tale and carry on like this for so long? Who was she? How do you know who anyone is, really? Anna was scheduled to appear in court on September 5th for the misdemeanors that had come out in the news, including her allegedly stolen stay at the Beekman, but she never appeared. I resumed communication with her via text message, not letting on that anything had changed. She had gone to the West Coast and was checked into a rehab in Malibu. In early October, when I was in Beverly Hills for Vanity Fair's annual New Establishment Summit, Anna and I arranged to have lunch. She never made it. She was arrested in Los Angeles on October 3rd and arraigned in a Manhattan court on October 26th. She is currently being held without bail on Rikers Island. Contacted for this article, Anna's attorney, Todd Spodek, had a much more pedestrian view of matters concerning Anna. The burden rests squarely with a lender to conduct the appropriate due diligence before extending credit of any type, he wrote, and to document the terms of the loan. This is a civil matter, and the appropriate recourse for Ms. Williams is to sue Ms. Sorokin for defaulting on a loan, not to initiate criminal charges. I submit that Ms. Williams does not have an iota of proof to support any agreement of any type whatsoever. Anna told me once that her plans would either work out or all go horribly wrong. Now I see what she meant. It was a magic trick. I'm embarrassed to say that I was one of the props, and the audience, too. Anna's was a beautiful dream of New York, like one of those nights that never seem to end. And then the bill arrives. Thank you. The Devil Inside. In the age of hashtag MeToo, Rosemary's Baby takes on special resonance. Lara Jacobs examines the hard truths and intractable horrors embedded in Roman Polanski's cult film. Opening photo, Mia Farrow, director Roman Polanski, and production designer Richard Silbert on the set of 1968's Rosemary's Baby. The year 1968 saw the premieres of four films that are now cult classics, each one dancing with doom. George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead was a black-and-white B-movie with a bled-out complexion. Unapologetically gruesome, its story of reanimated corpses who hunt meals of live human flesh rattled adults and left children in tears. Franklin J. Schaffner's Planet of the Apes envisioned a future in which Homo sapiens, having destroyed its own civilization through nuclear war, is relegated to the bottom rung of a new dominance hierarchy. Gorillas, chimps, and orangutans rule the world. Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, after presenting its own ensemble of prehistoric hominids, made a stylish marriage between speed of light technology and mankind. The marriage ends in divorce, and the bottom line is evolve or die out. The fourth picture, set in a Manhattan apartment building of Victorian vintage, hugged close to the hearth, too close, and is the only one of these four films framed through the eyes of a woman. This was Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby. 50 years later, Romero's zombies have their own maggoty territory in television's lineup of horror, while Planet of the Apes is a film franchise reinvigorated by motion capture recording. The last 8 years have seen the rise of, the dawn of, and the war for. Another matter entirely is 2001 A Space Odyssey. This sci-fi mind bend, which launched 1,000 questions and 1,000 super analytical answers, remains visually Mandarin and magisterial, a monolith of a movie. Rosemary's Baby is different from these. Its story of a young couple in 1960s New York City unspools like a soap opera, with the pedestrian pace of the everyday. Only instead of the angry upsets that propel your average soap, adultery, rivalry, long-lost relatives popping up out of nowhere, the upsets in Rosemary's Baby amount to little more than neighborly nosiness, nagging afterthoughts, strange smells, and small catches of coincidence. It's all easily explained away, and yet it all accumulates into something unthinkable, demonic. Rosemary may not have known what to expect of her first pregnancy, but she creepingly realizes it isn't this. Rosemary gave birth to a cloven-hoofed infant, wrote the film critic Pauline Kael, thumbnailing the plot. Her actor husband having mated her with Satan in exchange for a Broadway hit. For the record, we never see a cloven hoof, or even the baby, though we do hear it crying in its crib. In 1968, it was hard to know exactly what to call this movie. Horror, yes. Richard Silbert, the production designer of Rosemary's Baby, called it the greatest horror film without any horror in it. But it's also a psychological thriller, percolating with paranoia. Gynecological gothic is how Penelope Gilliatt, film critic of The New Yorker, described it. The critic Stanley Kaufman thought the movie began as a hip comedy with mystery overtones that then morphed into a mystery with comic overtones. It's a more powerful film the more you get away from characterizing it in a genre, says Owen Gleiberman, chief film critic at Variety. It doesn't play like a horror film. Rosemary's Baby is its own unique category of gothic New Hollywood metropolis, banality of evil nightmare. 50 years on, Rosemary's Baby still hovers queasily beyond definition. It touches the quick of the deepest feminist conundrums, yet never utters a polemical word, not even a sigh. Which may be why, in 2018, it is the most culturally relevant of these four classics. The movie was based on a novel of the same name by Ira Levin. And even before its publication in 1967, the book's galley was circulating in Hollywood. Levin was a gifted storyteller whose first novel, 1953's A Kiss Before Dying, about a handsome sociopath who will kill to marry money, had already been made into a film starring Robert Wagner and Joanne Woodward. In 1991, it was remade with Matt Dillon. Levin would go on to write a total of 7 novels, including 1972's The Stepford Wives, Body Snatching in Suburbia, and 1976's The Boys from Brazil, Let's Clone Hitler, as well as the 1978 play Death Trap, a tilt-a-whirl of twists and turns that to this day holds the record 1,793 performances for the longest-running comedy thriller on Broadway. Stephen King has called Levin the Swiss watchmaker of the suspense novel, and Truman Capote compared Rosemary's Baby to Henry James's feverish The Turn of the Screw. A hint, perhaps, that Levin's story actually does turn on a screw, the sexual kind. Its meticulous plotting is integrated with pacing that seems offhand and natural. But more than that, Levin's ability to defy formula, to combine genres, leaves the reader feeling a pervasive imbalance. Add to this Levin's pitch-perfect ear for titles that are semantically symbolic, Stepford Wife, for instance, is now a term for any domestic partner programmed into plastic, smiling submission, and you have writing made for the movies. With hardly a line that can't be found in the book, the screenplay Polanski fashioned from Rosemary's Baby is an utterly faithful film adaptation. What brews in this title? A slew of contradictions. Levin, who has written that he was standing the story of Mary and Jesus on its head, chose the name Rosemary, an elaboration on Mary, the Holy Mother. The name is also redolent of flower power purity, thanks to Simon and Garfunkel's 1966 version of the medieval ballad Scarborough Fair, with its botanical refrain, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Levin set the novel in 1965-66 and made the due date of Rosemary's pregnancy the month of June 666, the number of the beast, as foretold in the Book of Revelation. In that same year, Time magazine unsettled America with its April 8th cover story, Is God Dead? Later that month, in San Francisco, Anton LaVey founded the Church of Satan, declaring that 1966 was the year one, words Levin used verbatim in his novel. LaVey would later be falsely credited with working as a consultant on the film Rosemary's Baby. Cults of all kinds found fertile ground in this period, including the Family, formed in the late 60s by the monstrous Charles Manson, who alternately envisioned himself as Christ or the devil. This was the cult that would murder Polanski's pregnant wife, Sharon Tate, along with 4 others, in 1969. Having observed that the most suspenseful part of a horror story is before, not after, the horror appears, Levin wrote in the 2003 New American Library edition of Rosemary's Baby, "I was struck one day by the thought that a fetus could be an effective horror if the reader knew it was growing into something malignly different from the baby expected. 9 whole months of anticipation, with the horror inside the heroine." William Castle, the genial producer and director of low-budget movies, wanted to prove that he was up to an A-list film. And here was his opportunity to do it. According to the new book, This Is No Dream, Making Rosemary's Baby, an insightful study of the film, written by James Munn, with photographs by Bob Willoughby, Castle, as well as suspense master Alfred Hitchcock, was given the chance to option the screen rights to Rosemary's Baby. When Hitchcock passed on the project, Castle mortgaged his house and bought the rights for $100,000, plus another $50,000 if the novel hit the bestseller list. It did, with readers snapping up 2.5 million copies before the movie's release. Next photos, Pharaoh as Rosemary in labor, with Time's iconic cover, and on location at Tiffany & Company, 1967. Meanwhile, the young Robert Evans, a former actor who was new to producing, had teamed up with Paramount and was looking for the unexpected, he has said, something that sounded new. Hearing of Castle's purchase, he swooped in. They negotiated a deal to make the film together, and though Castle was gunning to direct, Evans and Paramount chief Charlie Bloodhorn pushed for Polanski, an emerging talent whose success with The Tinsel Repulsion and The Bizarre Cul-de-Sac suggested he could handle the sustained uncertainty. The sustained uncertainty, the atmospheric layers of Levin's book. Polanski started reading Rosemary's Baby, and at first it looked to him, he said, like a kitchen melodrama, you know, for television. But he kept going, couldn't stop, finished in hours, hooked. He could see the cinematic potential. And as Munn points out in his book, Castle was soon swayed by the director's potential, telling Bloodhorn, "Charlie, you were right. Roman Polanski is the only one who can direct Rosemary's Baby." When it came to casting, Polanski needed guidance. The character Rosemary Woodhouse is a lapsed Catholic from Omaha, and Polanski saw her as a corn-fed all-American girl, specifically Tuesday Weld. Evans, Castle, and Levin all wanted Mia Farrow. Introduced to American audiences in 1964 as virginal Allison McKenzie in the primetime television soap Peyton Place, Farrow saw her profile rise in 1966 when she married Frank Sinatra, who was 29 years older. They were a puzzling pair, the beatific waif and the Vegas big shot. Sinatra was dubious about Farrow's taking the role. Polanski feared she'd be too ethereal. But Evans, as Munn reports, was right on the money when he said that Farrow's fragility would give the picture real magic. Her milkmaid gentleness, her twiggy body, her large, unblinking blue eyes. Mia is the movie's soul. She's like a filament, the incandescent every girl in a Black Sabbath situation. Next photos, Rosemary discovers mysterious scratches. Polanski and director of photography William Fraker. Rosemary in the final scene. The trouble begins when young marrieds Rosemary and Guy Woodhouse, John Cassavetes, intense, ambitious, typecast, move into the Bramford, a lordly landmark building with an unsavory history of witchcraft. The gabled, fabled Dakota at West 72nd Street was used for exterior shots. Guy is feeling the approach of his sell-by date as an actor, and Rosemary is aching to start a family. Two birds are killed with one stone when the Woodhouses meet the tenants, whose apartment abuts theirs, an eccentric older couple named Roman and Minnie Castevet, played with smooth, sly wit by Sidney Blackmore and Ruth Gordon, both veterans of the stage. Guy connects with the Castevets, ministers for Mephistopheles, and within a few days a rival actor goes blind, and Guy inherits a lead role. Now he's ready to make a baby. Except it's not Guy who makes it. Rosemary is drugged, then carried into the Castevet living room. In a doozy of a dark erotic dream, Rosemary sees herself surrounded by a chanting coven while a scaly creature ritually rapes her. "This is no dream," a semi-conscious Rosemary cries midway through. "This is really happening." But the next morning, despite scratch marks on her body, she's convinced it was just a bad dream. Apologizing for his ragged nails, Guy says he didn't want to miss baby night and had sex with her while she slept. Marital rape was still legal in those days. As the opening credits roll, Rosemary's Baby looks like it's going to be a traditional woman's movie. The typeface used for the credits is the kind of hoity-toity cursive writing, in hot pink no less, one might see on a Tiffany & Company shower invitation. Indeed, 1959's Three Gals in the Big City flick, The Best of Everything, in which Robert Evans played a cad, opens with similarly pink and cursive credits. Rosemary's Baby, however, is no soap. It reinterprets the Faust legend with a twist. In exchange for stardom, Guy sells his wife, not his soul, to the devil. It also recalls Le Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring, the shudderingly modern 1913 work by Igor Stravinsky and Vaslav Nijinsky. A biological ballet, it was called at the time. A metaphor for regeneration. Le Sacre du Printemps sees a chosen maiden sacrificed to a pagan god, thus ensuring the future of the tribe. Last month, when Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, posed with her newborn third child, Prince Louis Arthur Charles, the red dress she wore with its white lace collar inspired a cascade of tweets noting the remarkable similarity, obviously unintended, to the dress worn by a pregnant Rosemary during the party scene. The Twitterverse kerfuffle came and went in a flash, but the movie is embedded in viewers' collective unconscious. Rosemary's Baby is resonant, says the film critic Molly Haskell, author of the book From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies, because it plays on something that's so human, which is the fear of a monster child. That's always there, and it's primal. It's a very well-done film, very controlled and beautifully shot and elegant. The cast is wonderful. What's so interesting about looking at movies again? You're different, and they're different. The thing that I kept thinking, Haskell says, of watching Rosemary's Baby in 2018, was that if she had known what she was carrying, would she have aborted it? And would audiences have supported such an act, or condemned it? Rosemary doesn't know what she's carrying. Realizing that forces are lined up against her, and that it has to do with her pregnancy, she thinks the coven wants the child for blood ceremonies. She doesn't know that her womb has been co-opted. I feel like the movie was always about the condition of being female in our world, says Gleiberman. It's one of the great movies made from a woman's point of view. It shows us fears about pregnancy and trust and the body that no other movie does. And yet, I've never seen it in ideological terms, as a feminist movie or anything like that. It's swirling around with all this stuff from the late 60s. The death of God, the rise of Satan, you can't trust your neighbors, and women rejecting their traditional roles. Or, in this case, their traditional roles rejecting them, with Rosemary literally experiencing pregnancy as a kind of invasion. It's the last great Hitchcock movie that Hitchcock never made. Released on June 12, 1968, Rosemary's Baby was a blockbuster, Evans has said, opening to the biggest business Paramount had done in years. Polanski, with his first studio picture, had proved himself in Hollywood, and Mia Farrow, whom Sinatra divorced because she wouldn't walk off the set when filming ran 5 weeks longer than expected, talk about standing up to patriarchy, skyrocketed to stardom overnight. While there was pushback from religious groups, especially Catholic organizations, who branded the subject of devil worship blasphemous, the movie was a must-see. As for the critics, those who wanted standard horror film frights and tropes often missed the subterranean themes. Andrew Saris, writing in the Village Voice, understood exactly what was going on. Two universal fears run through Rosemary's Baby. The fear of pregnancy, particularly as it consumes personality, and the fear of a deformed offspring with all the attendant moral and emotional complications. By dealing obliquely with these fears, the book and the movie penetrate deeper into the subconscious of the audience. Today it isn't devil worship or the invocation of Satan that troubles the viewer. It's that a man barters his wife's body, and that her destiny has been ruthlessly appropriated and perverted. I think it's a great movie, and I don't think I've done another, Mia Farrow said in a 2012 interview for the Criterion Collection. I know I didn't get another role as fine that ask as much of me. And I know I've never worked with a director that was as precise with me. It was the happiest work experience, the most fulfilling that I've ever had. Farrow declined to comment for this story. In these heated times, some might find it odd to hear that Farrow lavished such praise on Polanski, who, some 40 years ago, famously fled the country after pleading guilty to having had sex with a minor. The director, who recently referred to the hashtag MeToo movement as a form of mass hysteria that occurs in society from time to time, was ejected from the Motion Picture Academy in early May. His lawyer has threatened to sue. It's also hard not to hear in Farrow's comments an implicit jab at her former longtime partner Woody Allen, who directed her in 13 films. Or to avoid thinking back to Allen's love affair with one of her daughters, Soon Yi, now his wife. Not to mention the accusations of sexual abuse of Dylan, Allen and Farrow's much younger daughter, allegations Allen has long denied. Perhaps there is yet another genre, if unintended, inside Rosemary's Baby, the allegory. Sometimes our nightmares come not from the outside, but from under our own roof. Jordan Peele, the writer and director of the 2017 hit Get Out, rates Rosemary's Baby as probably my favorite film. In 2014, he ingeniously tweeted its entire story in emojis. In fact, he looked to Levin and Polanski for the tonal template of Get Out, channeling that feeling of foreboding in an idyllic setting, that sense of something stolen. Just as Get Out is a film about race, Rosemary's Baby, Peele has said, is a film about gender. It's about men making decisions about women's bodies behind their backs. Likewise, the divisive question that rips through the television series, The Handmaid's Tale, based on Margaret Atwood's vision of a country that turns fertile young women into broodmares, also haunts Rosemary's Baby. To whom does a womb belong? The woman, the church, or the state? In the movie's last scene, Rosemary has found her way into the Castevet apartment, where a crib dressed in black organza has pride of place, and a christening party is in progress. She carries a kitchen knife and is ready to kill to get her baby back. The room falls silent as she looks into the crib, only to cry, "What have you done to his eyes?" Roman blandly answers, "He has his father's eyes." Golden yellow, with vertical black slits for pupils. Backing away, appalled, Rosemary screams, "No, it can't be." She drops the knife and is left to weep while the witches chat. Then the creature cries. The primal pull, irrational, irreducible, draws Rosemary forward. During 25 seconds of quiet brilliance, Pharaoh pours her gaze into the crib, softness coming over her, a shadow of a smile, acceptance. This is the horror of the movie, and also its complicated power.
Thank you.
Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Laverne Cox, the actress and star of Orange is the New Black, discusses racism, self-image, and the myriad wonders of Leontine Price. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Cuddling in bed on a Sunday morning with the man I love. Also, applause and standing ovations. What is your greatest fear? Being homeless. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Eartha Kitt. Which living person do you most admire? Leontine Price gives me life. She broke racial barriers with inimitable poise, grace, and excellence, as well as unbelievable focus and vision. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself, thinking that I am less than? That thinking is cunning, baffling, and insidious, and I must guard against it every hour of every day. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Mean-spiritedness and the inability to set and respect boundaries. What is your favorite journey? After having lost myself in the muck of the world, finding my way back to the truth of who I am through vulnerability and truth-telling. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? I don't think virtue is overrated. The things we sometimes mistake for virtues are. On what occasion do you lie? I try not to lie, but when I do, it's often because I'm feeling insecure. Which living person do you most despise? I try not to despise anyone. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Girl, work, interrogate, critical intervention. What is your greatest regret? Je ne regrette rien. What or who is the greatest love of your life? The performing arts. They have been life-saving for me. When and where were you happiest? At the SAG Awards in 2016. I remember going into that night saying to myself, I might not be here again. Let me be fully in the moment. The cast of Orange is the New Black won the Acting Ensemble Award for the second year in a row, and I was there with a man I truly loved. That night was everything I had always dreamed about. Which talent would you most like to have? Singing classically like Leontine Price. What is your current state of mind? Grateful and anxious about the next chapter. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Thinking that I am not enough, or not beautiful the way I am. That thinking is super dangerous. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? The trauma passed down by my ancestors from the racial oppression they experienced during slavery and Jim Crow in Alabama. What do you consider your greatest achievement? With a lot of help and support, the pursuit of my dreams has helped create a space that didn't exist before for others to believe they can pursue and fulfill their dreams as well. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Leontine Price. Or Beyoncé. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Hating yourself. What do you most value in your friends? Honesty, loyalty, and unconditional support. Who are your favorite writers? Bell Hooks, Brené Brown, James Baldwin, Shakespeare. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Wonder Woman. Who are your heroes in real life? Oprah and Leontine Price. How would you like to die? Happy and having achieved all I wanted to. What is your motto? Stay in the love. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Laverne Cox.
Thank you.
More from the Vanity Fair agenda. Shop. Introducing Amanu, a new type of sandal. With over 400 possibilities for customization, materials from the finest Italian factories, and master-trained makers ready to build your sandal right in front of your eyes, Amanu represents a radical shift from the standard retail experience of today. The brainchild of celebrity stylist Anita Patrickson, this West Hollywood brand transports you the moment you step through the door. Once inside the immersive space, you'll be able to create a completely custom shoe, selecting from a range of styles, fabrics, and colors. Within 30 minutes, you'll walk out in a pair of sandals that not only fit perfectly, but also represent your personal style. Event. Stuart Weitzman celebrates the Fall 2018 collection. February 8th marked two major firsts for Stuart Weitzman, new creative director Giovanni Morelli's debut collection, and the brand's first time on the New York Fashion Week roster. The presentation, held at the Pool Restaurant in the historic Seagram Building, showcased a curated assortment of shoes, handbags, and jewelry. The brand toasted the momentous occasion with a star-studded cocktail party attended by high-wattage guests, including Solange Knowles, Dutzend Crows, and Nina Agdal.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.